Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome to our program, my friends. Happy Friday. Shabbat Shalom, TGIF. Hope you have a great weekend coming up. Coming up on today's program, first, Brunch with Bernie Sanders. In our second hour of our program, we're going to have Objectivist Jaron Brook on. He's going to tell us how smoking bans are unjust, and we'll have a little discussion about what's more important, adolescent selfishness or adult responsibility in society. And then Jeffrey Kleinman in the third hour of our program is going to be telling us what to look for in the new DVDs that are out. But first, as is always the case, the first hour of our Friday program, Congressman Bernie Sanders, Bernie.org, his website. Bernie Sanders is the only independent member of the House of Representatives, now running to be an independent member of the United States Senate to take independent Jim Jeffords' seat for the great state of Vermont. And Bernie.org, his website. And Bernie, you and I on this program, very rarely, if ever, in my recollection, we've been doing this for a couple of years, talk about your campaigns and about specific politics. Do you mind if I just raise a question about it, or is that I don't know where the boundaries are of what's appropriate and what's not? You could just tell me. I understand. I read in the paper that your opponent has tossed some huge wad of his own cash into this campaign, and that this campaign in Vermont has the probability of turning into, on a per capita basis, the most expensive campaign in the nation because you're running against the richest guy in the state or something?
Well, you got it mostly right. The fellow who I'm running against is, we think, the wealthiest guy in the state, and will probably spend maybe $10, $15 million of his own money. Now, in California, that may not seem like a whole lot of money for a campaign, but when you only have 620,000 people in the state, what it would amount to is more money being spent on a Senate campaign per voter, than any election in American history. So that is kind of what we're up against.
That's mind-boggling, and I know that you're not a multimillionaire. You're not tossing your own money.
No great secret there, yes.
Yeah, no, and that you have not been. You don't take money from. I mean, how are you going to do this?
Well, we are raising a reasonable sum of money. We have a lot of individual contributors from all over the country. We're getting support from labor unions, environmental groups, women's organizations, and so forth, and so on. Groups that want to see a progressive be in the United States Senate. What concerns me about the kind of money that's being spent in Vermont is not so much. Obviously, it causes a problem for us. We're going to win this election, but it causes a problem. But I'm very well known, and we're raising money and so forth. But what it really means, Tom, is that this business of just wealthy people, and sometimes the Democrats, sometimes the Republicans, saying, hey, I'm going to buy an election. It's coming to Vermont. We have seen it in other states. We've certainly seen it in California. We've seen it in Florida and so forth and so on. And
we saw New York with Bloomberg.
Yeah, and Bloomberg in New York, absolutely.
And $70 per
The bottom line here is what it says, if you make $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, say, you're a regular person, and you're interested in politics, and maybe you're a Democrat, maybe you're progressive, maybe you're Republican, whatever you may be, how in God's name, if you're a regular person, are you going to ever be successful in a campaign, taking on somebody who has huge sums of money? Now, I am raising a lot of money. I am well known in my state. I've been in Congress for 15 years. So, we're going into this campaign very, very strong. And I don't think the people of Vermont are going to let big money buy this election. But if you're a regular person in any state in the country, how do you compete against that? And what that just speaks to is the decline of our democracy and moving in a direction where if you got the money, you can run for office, you can get elected, or conversely, if you are willing to serve the interests of the wealthy and the powerful, even if you don't have the money, you can get elected. It's an awful thing, the degree to which money controls the political process, and we see it every single day on the floor of the House with virtually every major piece of legislation being bought and paid for by big money interests. It's a huge problem, not just in my campaign, but all over this country. It's an issue we've got to address, I think, through public funding of elections.
Yeah, ultimately the finest solution, although over the short term, we have candidates like yourself have to get out there and raise money. And I know that you're doing it with Bernie.org the way that Howard Dean was in 2004.
Right,
we're doing very well on
our website, raising a whole lot of money. We send out a lot of mail. We're getting a lot of support from ordinary, you know, people who are sending $30 or $50 or $100, and we appreciate that very much.
Yeah. I don't know if you knew that yesterday Cynthia McKinney read on the floor of the House an article that I wrote and got censured for it.
No, actually, I didn't.
Yeah. So if you speak to her, would you be sure to thank her for me?
I will.
we spoke with her briefly, but that was pretty amazing. What do you see as the biggest issue right now facing
Bernie Sanders?
Well, the big issues
that are coming down are this disastrous Bush budget, which in the name of trying to deal with the huge deficits that Bush has created, are going to cut back in a terrible way on the needs of the middle class and working families and lower-income people. You know, Tom, this guy in the White House still refers to himself as a compassionate conservative. There is nothing compassionate about cutting back on Medicaid, throwing children off of their health insurance, raising the premiums for lower-income Americans, cutting back on Medicare for hospitals, which means there'll be more cost-shifting. And I'll give you one example that I'm personally involved in, because it's a program that I brought to the state of Vermont, and I think about 32 states have it. There's a small program. It's not a huge program. It's called the Commodity Supplemental Food Program, which provides one bag of good quality groceries to low-income senior citizens every month. That's it. I think the groceries are worth $20, $30. I don't know what it is. And a lot of seniors in the state of Vermont and throughout this country once a month line up and they get this groceries, and it helps them. It just helps them get through the month when many of them are living on low fixed incomes. This president has decided that we can't afford to maintain that program. You're going to zero fund a program for low-income seniors, which provide them good quality nutrition.
He's going to wipe it out altogether?
Yeah, zero fund it completely. And at the same time, of course, he's continuing his effort to provide tax breaks for millionaires and billionaires. And the obscenity of this entire approach of cutting back on educational programs. They want to eliminate the TRIO program, which is a wonderful program. You know, my parents never went to college. And for first-generation kids going to college, it's often very difficult. It's a huge hurdle to overcome. You know, you don't have the confidence that the kids who are the sons and daughters of doctors and lawyers have. You know, this is a program that has worked enormously successful, keeping an eye on kids in high school and even lower than that, saying, look, you can go to college, even if your parents did not go to college. And mentoring these kids, providing tutoring, taking them to college campuses, it has been enormously successful, wants to eliminate that program. So when you talk about the needs of working families, of lower-income people, senior citizens, children, cuts, cuts, cuts. When you talk about making the wealthiest people in this country even wealthier, more tax breaks, more tax breaks, more tax breaks. And the results are clear to see. Since Bush has been president, 5 million Americans more have slipped into poverty, while the gap between the rich and the poor is wider today than it has been since before the Great Depression of 29. We have 6 million Americans who have lost their health insurance since Bush has been in office. And meanwhile, you have the CEOs of large corporations making over 400 times what their workers are making. So, you know, just the other day I was at the House Financial Services Committee. The new chairman of the Federal Reserve, Bernanke, came before us, as the law requires. And, you know, I asked them some questions about whether or not the Bush administration would finally change its economic policies, raise the minimum wage, begin to do something about our disastrous trade policies, do something about the growing gap between the rich and the poor. You know, and obviously they're not going to do it. But, you know, those are the kinds of issues that we as Americans have got to continue talking about.
When you were interrogating Ben Bernanke on the floor, the folks in our chat room were letting me know that someone had C-SPAN on, and, hey, Bernie's on the floor, or he's taking on Mr. Bernanke. Do you think that this guy is just a Greenspan clone? I mean, is he following the same right-wing policy?
Absolutely. I mean, it's like all the Bushes appoint these. They are, you know, they are going to continue developing policies. You know, his style may be a little bit different. He may phrase words a little bit differently. But, you know, ultimately they're there to represent the wealthy and large corporations. Here you have, you know, Tom, and I don't know if we've discussed this since the new statistics have come out, we now have a trade deficit of over $720 billion.
Mm.
Largest in history, substantial increase from last year's disastrous trade deficit.
And in part because of that, we've got, like, the United Arab Emirates able to buy our ports.
You got it.
I mean, this is incredible.
That is incredible. It's a whole other issue.
Yeah.
I mean, beyond belief is what it is. All right, but you have this trade that we've lost almost 3 million good-paying manufacturing jobs in the last 5 years. Any objective analysis of our trade policy says, hey, this thing is failing. This thing is failing. We're losing not only blue-collar jobs, not only is our automobile industry in the process of joining the furniture industry and telecommunications and every other industry and going down the tubes, we're now looking at the loss of white-collar jobs as well.
Yeah.
How could it be that we don't reverse that? And those are the issues we've got to face.
And then that's why we need to be politically active. And that's why we need to be supporting politicians who are out there speaking the truth to these things. Speaking of which, this hour, our Brunch with Bernie segment, Congressman Bernie Sanders with us. His website, bernie.org, B-E-R-N-I-E.org. It's the Tom Hartman Program. We'll be taking your calls when we come right back. 16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Well, there's many a strange impulse out on the plains of West Texas. There's many a young boy who feels things he can't comprehend. And a small town don't like it when somebody falls between sexes. No small town don't like it when a cowboy has feelings for men.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program at Willie Nelson's new song. Welcome back to our program. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders, bernie.org, his website. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466, if you'd like to call in. And let's start here with Ken in Detroit, Michigan. Hey, Ken, welcome. You are live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Hi, Tom, and hi, Bernie. I want you to know that my two parents met each other at Henry Wallace rally years and years ago. And
the former vice president.
Right. And I am a member, I'm a delegate to the Michigan Democratic Convention on tomorrow. And I am also in the Community Democrats, the president of the United Auto Workers, Ron Gettelfinger's in our membership. And I've agreed with you guys on almost everything, but I just decided to get in the mainstream and become a Democrat.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, to make a long story short, I get so frustrated because John Conyers has to go in the basement of a building to put on a hearing, that Bernie gets marginalized, that Tom, you don't get heard on enough stations, that anybody who cares about anything that's progressive gets pushed to the side.
Well, first of all, Ken, I want to tell you, I just spoke to the UAW. They had their national convention last week, and I was invited to speak, and it's a fantastic group of people, and certainly one of the great unions, not only now, but in the history of our country, who have led the effort in so many important fights. The issue, you know, that you're touching on is an issue that Tom and I talk about a lot, and that is corporate control over the media. The fact that mainstream media and corporate media deflect some of the most important issues facing ordinary Americans away from public discussion. The President of the United States has the worst job-creating record over the last 5 years in the modern history of America. Do you ever hear much about that?
Since Herbert Hoover.
Yeah, since Herbert Hoover. Do you ever hear much about that? The media allows this guy to say our economy is booming. In fact, the job creation under Bush has not kept up with our own population growth. Median average family household income has declined for four consecutive years. Gap between the rich and the poor is growing wider. Can you tell me, how often do you hear that discussion on television or the radio?
Yeah.
Do you ever hear it?
Ken is gone. But
Ken is gone. But, you know, I think listeners will know. We don't hear that. And so the issue of media, of how we force media to engage in serious debates about the issues that impact real Americans, is a major, major political issue. We've got to make demands on the newspapers, demands on radio stations. Now, in truth, we have made in the last few years, and I think, Tom, you will agree with me, some significant gains, right?
Oh, well, progressive talk radio is on the air.
Yeah.
Here we are.
5 years ago, there wasn't a progressive talk radio of worth mentioning, I think.
No, and now I'm being heard on over 80 radio stations.
You and Air America's out there. And
Sirius.
You know, various voices out there who are beginning to crack in to this right-wing extremism, which has dominated talk radio. Do we have a long, long way to go? We surely do. But we're making some progress.
Yeah, there you go. Dennis in Louisville, Kentucky. You're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Hello, gentlemen. It's the first time I've talked to you this year.
Well, thanks for calling.
This is what I have a problem with right now. I think that, you know, everybody needs to get come together and come to an agreement in unison, because we don't have voice, or we don't have a say-so in the media. We don't have a media that's paying attention to us. You know, if we're in unison, if we keep in unison, maybe they can hear us, sort of like Horton hears the Who. Maybe something will break through, and finally somebody will hear it. But my thing is, why aren't we calling these guys for what they really are? They're committing treason against this country. We're going in debt to China, communist China. We are doing business with the United Arab Emirates. We're allowing them to have control over our ports. It's a whole list of things that you can go on and on and on about. These guys are traitors to the country, and we need to point this out. If
Dennis,
you stay on message on that.
Dennis, you make an excellent point. I mean, that we have in my office, I have a list of quotes that my staff has put together from the heads of the largest corporations in America. And what they are saying time after time, in just so many words, is to hell with the United States of America, to hell with the middle class and the workers of this country. We're off to China. And if you don't like it, tough luck. And by the way, before we go completely to China or another country, we'd like a few billion dollars of corporate welfare from you to help us on our trip. They are saying this in so many words. Tom, you and I have discussed this Delphi Corporation situation in the Midwest, where this corporation wants to lower the wages of its workers by 50%, cut benefits, huge reduction, putting middle-class people into poverty. And a representative from the National Association of Manufacturers, he says, that's what's going to happen. That's what we have got to do in America today. So they're pauperizing our people, moving abroad. And Dennis is absolutely right. They have no allegiance, to the workers or the middle class of this country. And we have got to point that out. They are selling out our people. That has got to be made as clear as we possibly can.
Well said. Congressman Bernie Sanders, his website, bernie.org, B-E-R-N-I-E.org. Our telephone number, 866-440-8466, 440-THOM. It's 27 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman radio program, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
That's the message for democracy. If you want it, you've got to participate, my friends. Welcome back to the program. Tom Hartman, radio program here, helping you win the water cooler wars. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Bernie Sanders, Congressman Bernie Sanders with us. Our telephone number, 866-440-8466. Your calls for Bernie Sanders, Merrill in Everett, Washington, listening on Talk 1090 in Washington, in Seattle, I'm assuming. Merrill?
I love your show. I believe it was Bush Sr. who had said, the American worker has to be reduced down to a third world status and suffer for a little while, but after that everything is going to be beautiful. But I'd like to know what their definition is of beautiful and what they've got planned for us.
Well, Merrill, I don't know that if Bush said that, but I think what the real goal of corporate America and the Republican leadership, which represents corporate America, is to say to the American people, look, there are people in China today who work for 30 or 40 cents an hour. People in Mexico who work for 75 cents an hour or a buck an hour. And if you do not take cuts in your wages, cuts in your health care, if you do not give up your pensions, we don't have to deal with you. Because we're off to China. We're prepared to do that. We have done that. We're prepared to go to India. We're prepared to go to Mexico, to other countries where people are living on pennies a day. So you better shape up, American workers, because we are going to cut and cut and cut your standard of living. And any complaints, we're off and out of here. That's, I think, Merrill, what they have in mind. And they are selling us out big time. And unless we organize and elect people to Congress, to governor's offices, who are prepared to stand up and fight for the middle class and working class of this country, our kids are going to have a lower standard of living than we do. You know, Tom, we often talk in this country about the American dream, which means that, you know, people start with very little and they work hard and their kids, the hope is that their kids will do better than they have done. That was the case with my family. My father came to this country when he was 17 years of age. We never had much money. But what we are seeing now is the end of the American dream and the beginning of an American nightmare, where our kids, despite all of the technology out there, despite all of the increase in worker productivity, despite all of this globalization, everything being equal, our kids are going to have a lower standard of living than we do, worse benefits than we do, unless we change economic policies.
Yeah, in today's Wall Street Journal, Greg Ip writes under the headline, Bernanke sees long slog to trim U.S. trade deficit, noting that it has taken 10 years for the gap on trade and investment income, known as the current account deficit, to reach 6% of GDP. Mr. Bernanke told Congress it might take that long to reverse. It's been 10 years since GATT and NAFTA were signed.
That's right.
Gee, what a surprise. Insane trade policies, you end up with deficits.
You know, it's funny, Tom. I want to take more calls here, but just when you talk about the trade issue and you debate that issue on the floor of the House, the people who are pushing these trade agreements no longer even bother to talk about job creation anymore. They know that it's such an absurd argument because we have lost millions of jobs as a result of these trade policies. They've now reverted to its effect in the war against terrorism.
Oh, geez. Yeah,
that's really where it's at. They can't even, the economics can no longer be defended.
Yeah.
You remember they told us how many jobs it was going to be creating?
Obviously
it. The opposite is the truth.
Tom in Buxton, Maine on the line. Hey, Tom, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hello.
Hey.
Can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay. I wanted to ask Mr. Sanders a question. First of all, I wanted to give a little background, and I wanted him to know that I am a lifetime NRA member. I own several guns, and I'm also I have attended hunter safety in the past because I am an avid hunter. And my question for Mr. Sanders is, why haven't, or what is the take of the Republicans when it comes to the Dick Cheney incident? Because, quite frankly, in my own take, to any responsible gun owner and the NRA, according to their own website, knows that Dick Cheney was completely at fault for that. And I just cannot understand why the Republicans have not at least just condemned his actions for that shooting incident.
Well, I think you make an important point that I think Cheney himself has recognized that he was wrong. But what you're going to see, as always is the case, is a circling of the wagons to protect, in this case, the vice president, and tomorrow, whatever, to protect the president. That's all. These guys are hanging on, and they're not going to criticize their own.
Yeah, that's the bottom line. Patricia in Sacramento, California, KSAC. Hey, Patricia.
Hi. As a progressive congressman, I just want to thank you, first of all, for all the great work you do. But my question is in regards to, can you give us an insight as to, you know, when you conduct legislation or on a personal basis, you have discussions with other Republican colleagues. I'm sure they see these problems. You know, the war is not going good, the amounting debt, the loss of jobs. I mean, I'm sure they see these things. What is your insight? Do you believe that Republicans are just going along with the Bush administration because they fear the backlash, or are they telling you also their concerns? You know, do they share this growing concern and they just fear, some kind of backlash from the Bush administration? I'll hang up and let you answer.
Well, Patricia has asked a very good question, and I don't know that I can know enough to give her a 100% good answer. I mean, I think when you're talking about Republicans, you're talking about a lot of different people. What I can tell you, for example, is that many Republicans who I have worked with, who used to be enamored and accepted hook, line, and sinker the Bush position on unfettered free trade, they go back to their districts in the Midwest and they see their communities decimated because jobs have been lost, companies have moved, shut down and moved to China and so forth. And you know what? They come back and they're not prepared to vote for these free trade agreements. Meanwhile then, you know, as Patricia indicates, tremendous pressure is being put on them by the Bush administration. There are direct threats that they're not going to get campaign funding unless they continue to vote for these trade agreements. In terms of civil liberties, for example, I have worked as somebody who voted against the Patriot Act and brought forth the first legislation to amend some of the more onerous provisions of the Patriot Act. I have worked with some of the most conservative Republicans who say, my God, this Bush is not a conservative. You don't allow the NSA to spy on the American people without a court order. That's not conservative. That is big, big, big brother. And they're concerned about it. But to answer Patricia's question. I think there are a lot of Republicans who are worried about the economy. They're worried about civil liberties. But they are afraid. They are afraid to stand up and be accounted for because of the power of the Bush administration and the possible punitive action that comes from corporate America in terms of campaign funding. It has been a sad, to my mind, a very sad moment in American history where you've seen a party which has moved so far to the right, while at the same time you have many people in that party who say, no, this is wrong, but they haven't had the courage to stand up and say that.
Rich in Stowe, Vermont, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hi, Bernie.
Hi, Rick.
How
are
you doing?
Good.
Bernie, the point I want to make is this. I firmly believe that right-wing media is brainwashing a lot of good people in this country, and I think that's an issue that needs to be really examined and dealt with. And my mind says, follow the money. Follow the advertisers.
That's right.
You know, as a progressive party, Democratic Party, find out who these advertisers are. Let's not make it so lucrative for them anymore to be advertising on these stations.
Well, Rick makes a very good point. You know, Rick, we have held, I think, four town meetings in the state of Vermont on corporate control over the media, and your point is well taken. Look, follow the money, and the money is who owns these companies? Well, for a start, all of the large networks are owned by major media conglomerates. General Electric owns NBC, and on and on it goes. Disney owns ABC, et cetera. But also, who is sponsoring? Who is putting the money into sponsorship? And I think progressives should begin to take a page from our conservative friends. And if we're sick and tired of hearing right-wing biases and no progressive voices, somebody should start calling up these radio stations and starting getting a hold of these sponsors and say, excuse me, you know, we want different points of view. And if not, you know, we are not going to be purchasing your products or going to your stores.
Or the flip side, patronize the advertisers of this show.
conversely, show respect for those people who are willing to support a progressive point of view. So I think we have not done as much as the right wing has done in putting our dollars behind those people who are supporting us.
Shirley in Evansville, Indiana, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hello. I'd like to ask what Mr. Sanders, what he thinks the reasoning behind the Bush administration is for selling off the ports on the East Coast. And secondly, I think he's got them way underpriced. I mean, Mitch Daniels here is leasing our toll roads for $7 billion for 75 years. That's one little toll road across the state of Indiana. I just don't understand the reasoning for turning these ports over to an Arabian country.
Well, I wish, Shirley, I wish I could give you an explanation. It is incomprehensible to me. I mean, here we are, concerned about terrorism. Here we have the president every day telling us what potential threats exist, and in fact, they do exist. And then we are going to give control over our ports over to people who are not Americans. Doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. Shirley, I can't give you an explanation. What I can tell you is that there are a number of us in Congress who are going to do everything we can to try to stop this process.
Chick in Dover, Delaware. We have about 30 seconds, Chick. Maybe a question, and Bernie can answer it on the other side.
I have a statement. My proposal or my theory is that over the last 100 years, that the standard of living in the United States has increased and is on the decrease in direct proportion to union membership, and that the rhetoric in the conservative press and the Republican stance against unions is making our standard of living decline.
Yeah. Let me just say, I agree with Dick. I don't have to go more. I think he makes a very important point.
Yeah, well said. Okay. It's Bernie Sanders, our Brunch with Bernie segment. It's 45 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman radio program, the place where despair is not an option, my friends. Get active. Get out there and get active. We're talking with Bernie Sanders, Bernie.org, his website. We'll be right back.
Listening to the Tom Hartman program.
The moon is pulling at me. The moon is pulling at you. You swear to me it's the sun.
And welcome back to Talk Radio for the rest of us. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us. Bernie.org, his website. Ron in Newton, New Jersey. You're live and on the air with Bernie Sanders.
Hi, Congressman Sanders. How are you?
Good, Ron. How are you?
Pretty good. I have a question for you. Do you believe that Republican-backed U.S. corporations are selling out U.S. troops vis-a-vis shipping jobs over to communist China?
Well, I think that the result of our trade policies, you know, pushed by President Bush and other presidents, I must confess, are certainly strengthening China. There's no question about it. China is rapidly becoming one of the not only economic powers in the world, but one of the financial and military powers in the world. And I think our trade policies are making it harder from a national security point of view for us to defend ourselves. How do you have a strong military if you have to go overseas in order to get the parts and the equipment that you need? So to answer your question, yeah, I worry very much about the future of our defense capabilities if we're outsourcing our manufacturing capabilities.
Len in Ames, Iowa on the line. Hey, Len, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hey, how are you doing? I got a quick question, and I'll take my answer off the air. And I was wondering, if corporations are considered legal people and everything, why can't we go after them and prosecute them as a person? Because if I was to do some of these things as a corporation had done, I'd be thrown in jail and the key would be thrown away. Thank you.
Hey, Len, you asked a very interesting question. I think you got one of the experts in the country on the line right now, and that's Tom Hartman. Tom, you've written a book on that, haven't you?
Yeah, I have. It's called Unequal Protection, The Rise of
Corporate Dominance. Why don't you answer, Len?
Well, I just, you know, read my book, Len. We'll get into a long rant about it some other time. But I know, Bernie, you and I think alike on this issue. Are very similar.
I mean, Len has raised exactly right question. At some time, you know, Tom, you should, you know, go into length on that.
Yeah. Yeah, I will. But I don't want to, you know, this is, for this segment, I'd like people to be, you know, getting your takes on these issues. So,
but let me say, I agree with Len. We have given these CEOs huge protection under corporate law, and they do get away with murder day after day.
Indeed. Mike in Pebble Beach, California. Mike, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Yes, good morning from California, Bernie. Sometimes satire can illuminate argument for the pro-public funding argument. And in that sense, I ask, if money is free speech, as the canard by the Supreme Court has argued, why not allow citizens the ability to sell their votes to the highest bidder via a mutual fund in which vote proxies are managed by fund managers pledged to vote as we the people desire?
There you go.
Yeah. Well, in fact, in a way, we almost have that system, don't we? Nada in Spanaway, Washington. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Yes. My name is Adin, and I have two things that I am concerned about. Number one and most important is I am very disappointed in the way Congress is managing things in Congress. I do not think that Congress should be controlled or wooed by corporate lobbyists. I think Congress is supposed to listen to the people. If the corporate community wants something passed in the Congress, they should come to the people.
That's right.
And the people will decide. If those people, those corporations are being good to the people, that they're giving them good jobs and good pay, then the people will give them those grants that they want.
Good point, Adam.
You make a very good point, and that is exactly, to my mind, the most serious political problem that we have right now, and that is the power of big money in Washington, D.C., often reflected by their lobbyists. What I could tell you is that virtually every piece of legislation in my office and all over this country, we have gotten many, many calls from senior citizens about this disastrous prescription drug Medicare bill. Everybody should know that that bill was written by the pharmaceutical companies for the pharmaceutical companies. And not for senior citizens. In fact, the fellow who was chairman of the House Commerce Committee, a fellow named Billy Towson of Louisiana, who has since left Congress, is now the head of the pharmaceutical industry in Washington, D.C. He wrote the bill, now he represents the industry, and that goes on, you know, every single day. So NADA is quite right, and that is the issue that we have got to deal with. May Congress reflect the interest of ordinary Americans.
One quick last call. Vince in Daytona Beach, Florida.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call. First, I'll let you know real fast. I'm 41, and I'm a lifelong voting Republican, starting back with Reagan when I was in the military and absentee. And I just want to let you know that not all of us Republicans are extremely happy about what's going on with these trade policies. I'm middle class, and I'm working harder. I can't afford health insurance. I can't afford a lot of things, and I just see a lot of things that's going on, and I'm not sure what to do. I'm not totally ready to jump over to the other side yet because there's other issues, but bottom line, we're all Americans, and our country's getting torn apart. And
that's right.
I'm not sure what to do. I'm not by myself. And
no, you're not.
They're going to have to really reach out and do something with us.
No, Vince, thanks for calling, and you make a very good point. I mean, I talk to Republicans every day, and I talk to conservatives every day. There is huge concern about the direction of this country, the fact that so few people have so much wealth and so much power, and that we're not bringing people together. We're dividing people. So, Vince, thank you very much for your call. And I think, by the way, your call reflects the concerns of millions of Republicans who are unhappy with the direction which our country is going.
So do you think the House and the Senate are going to go Democratic?
I think it's up for play, but I think the Republicans are very nervous, and they, in fact, could lose both bodies.
That would be extraordinary. That would be extraordinary. From your lips to God's ears. Congressman Bernie Sanders, our Brunch with Bernie segment. Check out his website, Bernie.org. There's a pile of great information there, news stories, ways to contact Bernie Sanders. If you didn't get through on the program here, or if you prefer email, whatever. Thank you so much for being with us, Bernie.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Great speaking with you. It's 57 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Coming up in our next hour, Yaron Brook, we're going to talk about public smoking. What's the story with that? Should it be legal? Should it be illegal? What do you think? We'll be back.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to our program, my friends, the radio support group of, by, and for we, the people of the United States of America. Yaron Brook is the president and executive director of the Ayn Rand Institute. By the way, our quote for the day, the spirit of resistance to government from Thomas Jefferson is so valuable on certain occasions that I wish it always to be kept alive. Well, let's talk about that, the spirit of resistance to government. Yaron, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
You have recently opined in an op-ed piece published over at aynrand.org, aynrand.org, that there should be no bans whatsoever on smoking anywhere. Am I putting words in your mouth, or am I quoting you correctly?
Well, there should be no bans by government. That is, I think there should be a voluntary issue. There's certainly hotels and restaurants that have voluntarily decided to ban smoking. That's obviously legitimate. And as somebody who doesn't smoke or doesn't particularly like smelling smoke, I frequent restaurants that don't allow smoking, but I think it's wrong for our politicians, for our government, to get involved in this issue.
Now, isn't this really, you and I, for example, agree that drug use, for example, is a private medical issue, not a public criminal issue.
Absolutely. Okay.
But you know, I wouldn't want somebody driving down the street intoxicated on alcohol any more than I'd want somebody driving down the street intoxicated on pot. And I'm assuming that you would be of the same mind?
Absolutely. As long I don't want people driving down the street because they've smoked something or because they've drunk something, are now a risk to me, where they cannot react, where they cannot respond, and therefore become a risk to the well-being of other people on the street.
Okay, so here we have this article from the University of California, San Francisco. This news release just came out April 1st. April 1st of last year. In the first study of its kind, researchers have found that the number of heart attack victims admitted to a regional hospital dropped by 60% during the first 6 months that a smoke-free ordinance was in effect in that area. The study's authors attribute much of the sharp decline in acute myocardial infarctions to a near elimination of the rapid and harmful effects of secondhand smoke on blood platelets in the arteries that supply blood to the heart. The findings were reported at the scientific session of the American College of Cardiology meeting in Chicago. The study took place in Helena, Montana, where a smoke-free ordinance went into effect June 5, 2002, and was suspended in a legal challenge 6 months later. So they were able to look at it before, during, and after. And they saw a 60% drop in heart attacks among non-smokers.
Yep.
So I would suggest to you, Yaron, that by simply legalizing the introduction into the public air of an addictive and harmful substance, that what we are doing is we are putting people at risk just like drunk drivers are. I have no problem with people taking nicotine. I have no problem with people shooting it up. I think that we should, you know, let's pass out syringes to all these tobacco addicts and let them just sit around and shoot up their nicotine, or let them chew the gum, or let them put patches on. I got no problem with that. But when they put it in the air that I've got to breathe, I have a problem with it.
Well, the difference is that you have a choice of whether to enter a private establishment that allows smoking or not to enter that private establishment. If you don't want to be exposed to the smoke, you don't.
Not
have
if it's
to go
my
to
workplace.
Home who smokes?
Not if it's my workplace.
No,
and you were specifically in your article saying, you know, smoking in the workplace should be allowed as well.
No, I didn't. I never wrote that. Smoking in the workplace is a issue for the employer. That is, it is an issue for the person who owns the workplace.
So the employer is the king, and the employer gets
have
to decide whether I have to put up with smoke of other people or not.
Absolutely. The owner of the business, I believe in property rights, the owner of the business gets to decide whether you, and you can always quit if you don't like the environment in which you work. I mean, the same.
What about organizing a democracy in the workplace called a union and saying, hey, you know, we don't want smoking here?
I'm all for unions as long as I, as the owner of the business, have the right to fire you. Absolutely. I mean, you can organize in any way you want. I shouldn't, as the owner, shouldn't be able to restrict it. But I should also have the right to say, look, you guys are being disruptive, and I'm going to hire somebody else to replace you. I have no problems with unions as long as they don't get extra protection from the government.
So at what point, the fact of the matter is, you and I both know, there's a very small number of people who have a very large amount of capital in this country. You know, more than 70% of the wealth in this country is owned by fewer than 10% of the people in this country. And when you get into the more than 50% of the wealth is owned by less than 2% of the people in this country.
Yeah, but most people in this country are employed by small businesses. So,
no, it's not true.
That is true. And the fact is that I here run this institute, and my board of directors can decide that there should be a smoke-free workplace, or it can decide to allow smoking. And my employees can then decide, including myself, I can then decide whether I want to work here or not, based on the conditions.
But, I mean, isn't smoking fundamentally different because it uses the commons of the air? I mean, I have no problem with people being drunk around me as long as they're not driving. I have no problem with people taking heroin around me as long as they're not inflicting, spraying it in my face. But
you know that there's no science, and I don't want to get into discussion of the science because I think a lot of the science is dubious. But putting that aside, you know that there's no science that shows that smoking outside in what you call the commons, which we debated in the past, I don't recognize, but you know, just outside in public.
I have a niece
places.
With asthma who, if she was sitting, you know, 5 feet from somebody smoking outside in a public park, would end up in the hospital. Well, I don't know if she'd end up in the hospital, but she would end up in serious trouble.
Well, but she could move two steps away. I mean, that's ridiculous. I mean,
okay, but we're talking not about the public park here. We're talking about the workplace, and we're talking about business establishments.
And in business establishments in the workplace, I believe that people have choices. They can choose to work there or not to work there. They can choose.
But the reality is, many Americans don't have those choices.
The ability to choose whether what kind of regulate, you know, whether to allow smoking or not to allow smoking. I think that should be left. Just like what we do in our home should be left to us, what we do in the workplace should be left to the owner of the workplace. That's what property rights are about.
Should we not say to the tobacco companies, okay, this stuff is legal. I mean, I acknowledge tobacco is legal.
And you would actually make a lot of products that are not legal. So
that's correct.
As would I.
That's correct. But however, I would also say if you're going to sell a product that's only purpose, if used as directed, not purpose, but it's only if tobacco is the only product that is sold in America when used as directed causes death. And if you're going to sell a product like that, we are going to be very libertarian here and let you sell that. We're not going to let you promote it. Do you have a problem with that?
Absolutely. That's a violation of the free speech. You can't say on the one hand to people, you can act in a certain way, you can sell a certain product, but we're not allowed to you speak about it. Advertising, in my view, is 100% protected by free speech. I think that all the bans,
even advertising directed
alcohol,
toward children.
What's that?
Even advertising directed toward children. I mean, they're gonna sue that advertising.
I think generally children are protected class because they're not fully, you know, adult and rational, and I think it's okay to protect children. But other than protecting children, I think that this speech is completely protected. Just like, I think advertising liquor should be protected, and I think that ultimately if we have our way and drugs are legalized, then advertising drugs would be legal. People are not conditioned by their advertising. People have.
Then, if that's true, Yaron, why do advertisers spend billions of dollars a year if it doesn't get results?
Well, because we get enticed by these things, but we still make the choices. That is, people are still responsible for the choices they make. You can't blame the advertising because the beer companies put a bunch of bikini-clad, beautiful women on the screen to sell their alcohol doesn't make me a beer drinker.
No, but the reality is, and I think you and I are both old enough to know this, that if you grow up with the image of masculinity when you're 5, 10, 10 years old, the image of masculinity being the Marlboro man, you want to smoke Marlboros.
Well, you know, we both grew up with that image, I think, and I never wanted to smoke Marlboro, and I made that choice when I was 17 or whatever, when cigarettes were available, and I chose not to do it, and the same is true with alcohol.
Well, you have more willpower than I
do. Make a choice at some point. What's that?
Yeah. I say you have more willpower than I did. I didn't quit smoking until Louise got pregnant with our oldest child. So.
Well, I mean, but we each made choices. Are you going to blame it on the culture? Are you going to blame it on the world? Or are you going to say, you know, I made a bad decision?
I'm going to say that there is a time when we as a society say there are certain appropriate boundaries that we're going to establish for public safety, whether it's child-safe electrical outlets or whether it's seatbelt usage. I mean, I resent having to fasten my seatbelt, but I acknowledge that it's the best thing for me and for society. And the "and for society" part is the part that I think is the most important.
I think that's a very dangerous slippery slope because it makes the state then responsible for our well-being.
But the reverse of it, Yaron, is that the only people responsible end up being the capitalists, that small number of very wealthy people who run the businesses.
The opposite is that those who are not responsible get to pay the price for being not responsible. That is, if you don't put on your seatbelt when you know it's good for you, then you're the one who's going to suffer the consequences of
it. But so is society. If somebody dies because they didn't have their seatbelt on and you know they're using a public hospital, I'm paying for part of it.
Yeah, well, you shouldn't be. In a capitalist system, you wouldn't be paying.
There would be no public hospital. Okay.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, I'm, you know, there's a loss to society as a whole from their productivity. We could argue that. In any case, Eric,
but I don't care about society as a whole in that sense.
I understand. Yeah. I understand. Ayanrand.org, AYNRAND.org. Yaron, thank you so much for being with us. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Mama, don't let your babies grow up to be cowboys. Don't let them pick guitars and drive an old truck. Make them be doctors and lawyers and such.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Truth in Broadcasting for a change in America. Ellen Ratner's with us with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Hey, Ellen.
Well, you know, it's interesting, Tom. I have been on the air with a friend of mine who's a Republican for about 12 years. That's Congressman Joel Heffley from the 5th District in Colorado, which is none other than Colorado Springs, a very, very conservative district.
Mm-hmm.
And as you recall, Joel Heffley was head of the Ethics Committee.
That's right.
And then...
And he got bounced off because he wouldn't go along with Tom DeLay.
Exactly. Well,
got replaced by Doc, what's his name, from Seattle or from Washington State.
He is hanging up his spurs, and he is getting out of there. But it's interesting. I had him on the air yesterday, and he said to me that he was essentially, he said, you know, the leadership just does what they want. They don't pay any attention to what the rank-and-file members of Congress want.
Right.
Now, for him to say that as a Republican was quite a statement.
Well, isn't it increasingly obvious?
Well, I think it's increasingly obvious, but very rarely do you see Republicans being that open about what's going on.
Well, the guy's not running for re-election, right?
Right. He has nothing to lose or gain.
Yeah, so he's just telling the truth. Well, actually, he probably has something to lose. He probably could have passed along a political dynasty to the person of his choice, and probably blowing that chance by saying this.
Well, actually, it's interesting because his wife is a member of the state legislature in Colorado, and a lot of people thought she would run, but I think he is, honestly, I know him very well, he is so disgusted by what is going on in Washington that he's just out of there.
Yeah, we just, in the first hour of this program, every Friday, we have Bernie Sanders on for an hour. And have for, what, 2 years, over 2 years now. And in the last hour, we had a call from a guy who says, you know, I'm a Republican, and I'm fed up with this party. And I'm a Republican, and I don't know what to do. It's like, what's a Republican to do, Ellen? I mean, you're on a lot of the conservative talk shows.
Are you hearing any kind of blowback? You know, it's interesting. Christy Todd Whitman wrote a book about a year ago called It's Not My Party, or It's My Party,
right.
Too, or one of those books.
Yeah.
And it sold less than 10,000 copies. So there has not been a real movement, but there is actually a group called Main Street Republicans in Washington, and actually they'd be great guests to get on. They're very, I mean, they are what people call Rockefeller Republicans, although it always makes me cringe because of Rockefeller's drug laws here in New York State.
Right.
But I think that it is interesting. There is a group of people that is really tired of it, and it's just a question of whether they can get enough muster up to get an agenda and to work with some of the Democrats and really push away the right-wingers.
Yeah, because what's happened really is that the Republican Party has been hijacked by extremists who don't share the values of the traditional Republican Party.
Right, exactly.
And largely since Ronald Reagan. I mean, Reagan, Reagan was considered a kook inside his own party for a long time.
And then you had Grover Norquist wanting to build a monument to him in every county in the United States.
Every county?
Oh, that is Grover Norquist's goal, to build a monument to Ronald Reagan in every county in the United States.
Oh, my. That man is in serious need of psychiatric assistance.
Isn't that wild?
Now, yeah, it is. So today is Friday. Is Congress in session? What's going on in Washington, D.C. today?
Sort of barely. What's interesting is the president, of course, is giving his big speech on the war on terror. He's at an Air Force base in Florida, of course, where else, a CENTCOM base in Florida. And he's also attending a fundraiser. Now, that makes his third fundraiser this week. He's asking for $20 billion more in addition to the supplemental for the war for Katrina, but the guy has not gone to one fundraiser for Katrina, but he's gone to three this week for the Republican Party.
Well, surprise, surprise. I mean, you know, that's all he has left for this party, it seems, is the ability to raise money.
And not much support from a lot of Republicans either. As you know, Republican Wilson from New Mexico is really not letting go of this issue on the Intelligence Committee.
Is that Heather Wilson?
Heather Wilson, that's right.
Yeah. Now, it seems to me that with what Pat Roberts is doing and what Mike DeWine, I guess, has actually put together the legislation that Pat Roberts was speaking well of.
He's just doing it to appease Robertson.
Yeah, and Roberts was praising it this morning. What these guys are going to try and do is they're going to try and make Bush's illegal wiretapping legal legislatively, and then kind of pretend that he never did it back when it was illegal.
Right. Essentially, what they're trying to do is backlog and say that the president has the ability to do that, so that when the case goes before the Supreme Court, it doesn't have a leg to stand on, and therefore doesn't go to the Supreme Court. That's really the strategy.
Oh, that's interesting. So you keep it. Yeah, but what happens if the Democrats?
Because what's going to happen is, places like the Center for Constitutional Rights, ACLU, the two people that have the wiretapping case, are going to, obviously, it's going to go up through the federal court. Some federal court judge is going to vote in Center for Constitutional Rights and ACLU's favor, and then it will go up the line until eventually it reaches the Supreme Court. But if they can then, you have to have standing. In other words, there has to be a law that the Supreme Court can deal with. So if they put in a law that essentially acts retroactively, then it doesn't have standing, and therefore it won't go to the Supreme Court.
But I thought there was a constitutional prohibition against ex post facto laws, against laws that are retroactive like that.
You know, these guys can pull off anything.
Yeah, well, it certainly seems like they can. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Ellen, thank you for your report today. Good talking
with you.
Have a great weekend. It's 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, The Pill That Will Help You Escape the Matrix. We'll be back with your calls and some little news here right after this.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Lie down, people. Lay down your Bill of Rights. Tell James Madison we had to let those amendments go.
Welcome back.
The opium crop was blown away. Let them poppies grow. Thanks to U.S. troops, it's back today. Only goes to show. Go down Wall Street, sell off my shares today. Tell my broker, put it all in blow.
Welcome back, my friends. It's exposing the con and conservative. Yeah, it's getting a little strange there in Wall Street, I'll tell you. Very, very strange things happening. In fact,
now, behind enemy lines.
Yes, behind enemy lines. This, the right-wing spin, before the right-wing starts spinning the right-wing spin. This, the press release that went out to all the talk show hosts this morning. Hillary Clinton's double standard reporting accidents. They are going to be talking about Hillary's famous 30-hour delay in reporting that she had found the alleged suicide note of Vince Foster, and that 5 years ago, the car that she was driving in was involved in, they say, a traffic altercation. Apparently what it did was it drove past a security checkpoint without stopping. But this is going to be one of the right-wing talking points guaranteed for today. So just so you know. Thought you'd want to know a little in advance. And, of course, the other big point for the week, I guess, and probably for the month, that little noticed order that gave Dick Cheney new power, as Byron York refers to it in the National Review. Dick Cheney and on Fox News said there is an executive order that gives him the ability to declassify classified intelligence. Now, the law does not. It gives the president that power, but not the vice president. The vice president is not part of the executive branch. He's part of, technically, he's part of the legislative branch. He's the president of the Senate, until or unless the president is either impeached or becomes incapacitated or dies, God forbid, then the vice president takes his place. Okay, so the vice president has never had the powers of the president. And there was an executive order issued back in 1995 by Bill Clinton, April 17, 1995, Executive Order 12958, which gave the president the power to declassify things. In fact, this original 1995 executive order said classification authority, A, the authority to classify information originally may be exercised only by, one, the president, two, agency heads and officials designated by the president in the Federal Register. And Bush changed this on March 25th, 2003. Now, David, can you track down what the date of the Valerie Plame outing was? I would love to know, to put this into context. On March 25th, 2003, maybe somebody in the chat room will know. On March 25th, 2003, Bush issued a new executive order. This is Executive Order 13292, and this is the one Dick Cheney was talking about. That changes the language under the classification authority from the president to say the president and, in the performance of executive duties, the vice president. Okay. And then a little later on, there's in the original Clinton original order, it said top secret original classification authority may be delegated only by the president or by an agency head or official designated. In other words, it's back to the executive branch. But Bush changed that with this new executive order. In 2003, to say top secret original classification authority may be delegated only by the president in the performance of executive duties of the vice president or an agency head. And finally, the original classification authority includes an individual authorized in writing either by the president, the vice president in performance of executive duties, or by agency heads. In other words, by executive order, President Bush changed the Constitution, essentially, and gave Dick Cheney executive powers that the vice president in the 230-plus year history of the United States never had before. And so Cheney is positioning himself to say, Scooter Libby released that information, but it wasn't classified because I told him to, and I have the authority to declassify things. So you can't prosecute me. is what Cheney is going to say. And he's already laid out his defense on Fox News last week, or this week. The other thing that he and Bush could be prosecuted for, there's you know, you find websites, you know, the top 50 crimes of the Bush administration, but the other big one from the last week or two is the NSA wiretapping scandal of, you know, wiretapping American citizens. And so now what we have is Senator Mike DeWine of Ohio putting together legislation which will make what the president has been doing since 2001, since before 9/11, spying on Americans without a warrant, will make that illegal, or will make that legal, excuse me. If you go back to the 1972 case decided essentially against Richard Nixon, United States versus United States District Court, it says, and I quote, Section 25113 is merely a disclaimer of congressional intent to define presidential powers and is not a grant of authority to conduct warrantless national search surveillances. They go on to say the Fourth Amendment, this is a Supreme Court decision, 1992, the Fourth Amendment, which shields private speech from unreasonable surveillance, requires prior judicial approval. And then they go on to say the government's duty to safeguard domestic security must be weighed against the potential danger that unreasonable surveillance poses to individual privacy and free expression. Well, this is very interesting. Valerie Plame was outed by Robert Novak on July 14, 2003. So it was about 3 months before that that Dick Cheney was given by executive order the authority to declassify anything he wanted. You wonder if, could it be that Bush, that Cheney said to Bush, you're going to give me this power. Bush did it, and then Cheney proceeded to use that power to try to destroy Joe Wilson. Fascinating. Fascinating. So anyhow, these are the issues of the day, in my opinion. And that, a few others. We've got a few other things we're going to get to as we continue on with the program. First, let's take a few phone calls. 866-440-8466. Our telephone number is Scott in Springfield, Illinois. Hey, Scott, what's on your mind today?
Whose workplace are you going to protect?
Say that again?
When you get down to whose workplace you're going to protect, if a police officer stops you, he has to inspect your car. So now your car is now his workplace. If a UPS guy comes to deliver a package to your house is now his workplace. So now you have to protect your house.
Well, Scott? Let's start over at the very beginning here. You're arguing that that smoking in the workplace should not be prohibited. Is that the point that you're making?
No, because you have a choice of whether or not to work there. You don't have to take the job.
Right. I understand. That's the position that you're on took, and that's the position you're taking. I disagree with it. I think in this economy, by and large, people don't have that much of a choice in what jobs they're going to take. And if all employers were to allow smoking, you know, right across the board, I'm not going to be able to say, I think I'll take a $10,000 a year cut in pay to not have to put up with smoke. That's not a kind of decision that I think we should force people into.
Well, and we tried to do that in Illinois with the smoking ban they passed in Springfield here recently. They tried to make an exception for private clubs, places with a smoke heater or with a separate place for smoking to do, and that was fine. We had a petition. It went around town. Everybody signed it. It was fine. Then at the last minute, they took that out because it wouldn't pass without taking that out.
Yeah.
So we got hosed at the last minute. Even though everybody did this petition and everything else, now we get stuck with a smoking ban. To come November, you can't smoke anywhere. And
it's a really tough one, Scott, because I think that, you know, if I wanted to open my house to my friends and say, come on over, or even perhaps run it as a business to say, come on over and I'm going to charge you $5 to come in and you can smoke all you want, you know, yeah, or whatever, I think that should be legal. But on the other hand, if I'm hiring people, I'm subjecting them then to a cancer-causing substance in the workplace that's part of their work milieu. And I just, you know, I just don't see tobacco addicts as being a protected class. I don't.
Okay.
Which is essentially what you and Yaron were arguing. As I said, I have no problem. I have no problem with people shooting up nicotine or putting, you know, chewing gum or taking patches. I got no problem with that in the workplace.
Sure.
I'm not objecting to people taking drugs in the workplace. I'm objecting to them polluting the air in the workplace.
All right. One other point.
Yeah.
Free Irwin Schiff and Cindy Noon.
Okay. All right. Thanks a lot, Scott. Jerry in Olympia, Washington. Hey, Jerry.
Yeah, Tom. Some of these arguments on smokers' rights get so mushy and seem absurd to me. And I keep mishearing you when you're referring to the earlier guest's speaking on the topic. I keep thinking he's a judge. I think you're saying Your Honor, but
no, it's Yaron is how you spell his name. And
but I saw a
Yaron
segment on TV on the Daily Show, and they were talking about this, and the comedian says, "Well, do you think I should be allowed to masturbate in the restaurant?" And the guy looks, you know, blankly back. And, it's almost reduced to that level of absurdity to say that you can...
Yeah, that's
that people have to use.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's the point. Is at a certain level, you're inflicting your behaviors on others. And there are some behaviors that can be done discreetly. You know, chewing on nicotine gum can be done discreetly. Blowing smoke in the air cannot. And that's my stand on it. Jerry, thanks a lot for the call. Ann in Tacoma. And Ann, we have just a few seconds left. What's up?
Hi, I agree that smoking really is a problem and needs to be even more tightly regulated. I think that the next phase is going to be multiple unit dwellings because, you know, smoke permeates, and if
you're right,
you have to rent.
Yeah, well, in fact, back in the early days when Louise and I were first married back 30 years, more than 30 years ago now, we have lived in apartments. After I quit smoking, I got real sensitive to smoke. I think being a smoker caused me to become allergic to it.
Same with me.
Yeah, and we lived in apartments where the people next door were smoking, and it was making just blowing my throat out. I know exactly what you're talking about, Ann. Thanks a lot for the call. 45 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
I'm walking there in the steps that you put down.
And welcome back, my friends.
I'm walking there in the steps that you put down.
Speaking from behind the good old working class stainless steel microphone, Tom Hartman here with you. 9 minutes, coming up on 9 minutes before the hour. Louise informs me Larry Klayman, JudicialWatch.org, the right-wing group that filed the initial lawsuit that led to the discovery of Monica Lewinsky, and also filed the lawsuit that led to the discovery of Dick Cheney's Energy Task Force going to the Supreme Court, and led to the discovery that Cheney and Bush, before 9/11, had been secretly meeting with oil companies and dividing up the country of Iraq for their oil fields. Larry Klayman has apparently filed a lawsuit against the Bush administration for illegal surveillance. So we'll be checking that out and bringing you that information. The next hour, we've got a Berlusconi alert coming up for you and a whole bunch more news. Right now, let's see here. We've got Jason in Pikeville, Kentucky. Hey, Jason, welcome to the program.
Hi, sir. I'm a long-time listener, first-time caller, but...
Well, thank you for calling.
You're welcome. I'm a fish and game warden, and I got a couple comments. Right now I'm taking a load of fish to a private lake so they can stock it.
Uh-huh.
The other thing is, I was wondering if I'm correct. I read an article about Dick Cheney getting to send a donation in and then sending in a check for his stamp, his $7 stamp.
Right.
How in the world did he get away with that? Because in my knowledge, I've been a game warden for 10 years now, and in my knowledge, we write a $500 ticket here in Kentucky for it, and
yeah,
you are required not to hunt anymore.
Here's how he got away with it, Jason. The bird stamp has only been law in Texas for 7 or 8 months. It's relatively new, and because it was a new law, essentially a new tax. You know, the stamp is really basically a tax. Because it was a new law, they put a provision into the law that said that if anybody screws up during the first year because they don't know about the law, then all they have to do is pay for the stamp and like a $25 fine or something like that. So I'm the last person on earth here to defend Dick Cheney. And I'm strongly of the opinion that, number one, he's confessed to drinking alcohol before he went out shooting. And number two, he said that as soon as he got done shooting this guy, he went back and drank some alcohol before the police showed up. He had a cocktail. That says to me he's he's getting himself ready for a breathalyzer, and he's going to have cover. I think the guy's got a serious problem. He's got two drunken driving convictions on his record. He's the first vice president in history to be convicted of a crime, and they were both alcohol-related crimes. I think he's got a big problem, but I don't think his problem is the stamp.
Yeah, I mean, another thing is alcohol comes with it. You know, we run into, hunters that have been drinking. We run into fishers that have been drinking. And, you know, there's really nothing we can do to them unless they have an open container right there on the spot.
Well, unless they shot somebody. Then you bring in the police.
Yeah. What I don't understand is, regardless if it's, I don't know Texas law, but regardless, like here in Kentucky, we have several farms that are deer farms. People go out, pay big money to go hunt deer, birds, quails, and people go pay to fish. Now, from my knowledge, the law enforcement goes in, but then due to it being a hunting accident, they call in the game warden to do his investigation. And far as I heard, no game warden was allowed to do an investigation. They had to,
Well, that's because this was on private land, not public land.
It doesn't matter. I mean,
it doesn't.
I said, no, in Kentucky, it doesn't matter if it's private land or not. If there's a shooting, an accidental shooting, it doesn't matter if you are on private land or on public land. There still has to be an inquiry by a game warden because you are out hunting.
Well, that's very interesting, Jason. It may be that the Texas law is different, or it may just be that this is another example of Dick Cheney asserting and probably truly believing that he lives in a separate and parallel universe from the rest of us. Jason, thanks a lot for the call. It's good to hear from you. Jeff in Eatonville, Washington. Hey, Jeff.
Hi, Tom. Great show. I learned so much for it. And
thank you.
This morning, after hearing about the ports being bought off the East Coast,
right,
I called Senator Cantwell's office for Washington State, and was explained to me that a British holding company owned that. I'm trying to figure out if it's the rights or if they actually own the physical ports. And the British holding company was bought by a group in Saudi Arabia.
That's true. That's the case. Yeah, that's exactly right. And the British holding company owned these six port areas. I mean, it's not the entire port, but it's a good chunk of them. And it wasn't Saudi Arabia. It's the United Arab Emirates. And a UAE company bought it from the British company. See, so much of the United States is being sold off. It is just mind-boggling. You don't walk around and look at, for example, Random House, the company that publishes a lot of my books. They're owned by Bertelsmann in Germany. The biggest publishers in America are owned by the French and German companies. You got big chunks of America being owned by Chinese, by Japanese companies. I mean, just increasingly our country itself is being sold off, because all of these countries have all this money from us buying the cheap junk from China, or for that matter, expensive junk, and they got to put the money someplace. So they're putting it here. They're buying us up.
Yeah,
but Cantwell's office was right. It was a UK company.
Like the I heard that the federal government's selling off our national forests for pennies an acre.
Yeah.
Way under the,
Well, that's the plan. That was just proposed by the Bush administration. Here, just in the state of Oregon, 10,000 acres. And a lot of these, through the Columbia River Gorge, there's a whole bunch of parcels that are like a half an acre, 1 acre, 1.5 acres, 5.6 acres. And they're saying that they're doing it for timber sales. I'm sorry, you don't sell, 6-tenths of an acre for a timber sale. You sell it because some campaign contributor wants to build a house on the Columbia River Gorge. It's just bizarre what's going on with the Bush administration. Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. We got to wrap up this segment of the hour. We'll be back in the next hour with a Berlusconi alert. We're going to get into, what's new in DVDs. I got to tell you about this wiretapping probe. Twilight Zone alert coming up. And what's the Bush administration doing having CEOs be our new ambassadors? This is going to boggle your mind. It's right out of today's Wall Street Journal. Well, that and more when we come back. It's 57 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where smart people get their news.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, 7 days now since 7 days has passed, or have passed, what is it, 6 days have passed, actually, I guess, with nobody being shot by the vice president. Amazing. Amazing. Step by step, we're making progress, aren't we? Oh, my. And now, time for our Berlusconi alerts. Yes, indeed. You'll recall Silvio Berlusconi, small-time crook in Italy, and small-time businessman and entrepreneur, and along with a couple of his crooked friends, several of whom are now in prison from their joint ventures with him in the early days. Bought a radio station, and then he bought a TV station, then he bought another radio station, then he bought another TV station, then he bought the radio network, and then he bought the TV network, and then he bought another radio network, and he bought another TV network, he bought some more radio stations, bought a newspaper, a couple more newspapers, some magazines, another radio station, until he controlled about 95% of the media in Italy. At which point, Silvio Berlusconi ran for prime minister, or his party ran so that he could become prime minister, and guess who won? Silvio Berlusconi! Well, that was 5-6 years ago. Now he's up for re-election. And this from the Independent in the UK, article by Peter Popham. With the general election less than a month away, Silvio Berlusconi has taken aim at one of the last remaining bastions of objectivity on the Italian airwaves. He's going after the Italian equivalent of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting in the United States, or BBC, in the UK. There's a program called Bellaro. It's shown weekly on RAI, which is the Italian equivalent of public television, a once-a-week program that is scrupulously neutral, painstakingly neutral, is how it's described by the Independent. He's describing them as scandalous. He says, that program is a weapon of war with tailor-made reports. Now, this is the same guy who 2 years ago, when he first, or three, 4 years ago, when he first became prime minister, he fired two of RAI's most respected and senior journalists, Enzo Baligi and Michel Santoro, because they dared report about him. In addition to owning three Mediaset TV channels, Mr. Berlusconi indirectly controls RAI, giving him a devastating advantage over his opponent. So the sayings of Berlusconi. Solo mio. It's all about Silvio. He says, I am the Jesus Christ of politics. He says, only Napoleon did more than me, but I'm certainly taller than him. Our Berlusconi alert for the day. A cautionary tale for us in America of what happens when there are no limitations on who can own how much of a nation's media. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number, Friday afternoon here. Pretty much anything you'd like to talk about is fine with me. Elaine in Eureka, California. Hey, Elaine, thanks for listening to KGOE there in Eureka. Elaine? I cannot hear you. Alex, if you need to do something, I can't hear you, Elaine. Or maybe we should just move along. Let's try. Oh, she's on there now. Hey, Elaine. I can hear you just fine. What's
up? All right. How long has it been since you've heard the phrase from this administration, the New World Order?
I haven't heard it from this administration. I heard it from Bush Sr., and I think that was the last time it was heard by anybody.
Well,
at least in government.
Bush Jr., I saw him on TV here about 3 years ago, mm-hmm. stating that he would restore Babylon. It would be the world headquarters. And that person, why is he building all those permanent military bases in Iraq? It's all for this New World Order. Mm-hmm. And just because they're not talking about it doesn't mean it's not in effect.
No, I agree with you. And you know what the New World Order is. It's a world of, by, and for big multinational corporations and inherited wealth. It is the world that conservatives have been lusting after ever since the 1770s, when you had Sir Edmund Burke having his famous debates with Thomas Paine.
And it's to make peons out of the majority of us.
That's right. That's what trickle-down
like
economics does. Yep.
Just like China.
You're right. You're right. I agree with you, Elaine. Thank you very much for the call. Good to hear
Thank
from you.
You.
Roy in Rio Rancho, New Mexico. Hey, Roy.
Good afternoon, Tom. I just had to, throw it out for a little bit of motivation for some folks over the weekend.
Okay.
New Mexico now has verifiable paper ballots required for every election in this state.
That's great.
Some serious guys did some serious work. They created the parade.
The governor got out in front of it. Fortunately, we had a Democratic-controlled roundhouse because it was pretty much party-line vote. But it went down, and about 6 hours before the session closed, it was enacted into the law. The governor said he's going to sign it. There's a couple little things that we don't like about it, and it's not perfect because they're still, you know, they're talking about machines, but at least we've got ballots that we can look at and we can recount.
Yeah. Now, here's a question for you, Roy. If those ballots are being generated by somebody pushing buttons on a screen, how do you know that the information, that the button you pushed is being recorded on the paper?
No, these are, here's your piece of paper, here's your marker, mark it up, run it through the scanner.
Ah, okay, great.
And or the optical scanner.
Yeah, now we know the optical scan machines can be hacked, but at least you've got a paper trail.
If you make a mistake, it's going to kick it back to you. Now, we can't control the programming.
Right.
But there is an audit, random quality control audit.
That's amazing. These are the things that they've actually just made illegal in Ohio.
This is absolutely the fine. New Mexico now has the finest election laws in the country.
Good on you, Roy.
And it's, you know, and I was a periphery guy. You know, I was talking.
But you participated in this. Without activists like you, this wouldn't have happened, Roy.
And we were passing the word, and we got up there for some committee hearings, and we called folks, and we, you know, we just bothered them.
Mm-hmm.
And they finally went along with us. And like I said, the governor didn't like it. It took 6 months to get him to even listen to the proposals.
Yeah.
And we generated so much excitement. It's the old thing of the leader, the politician who thinks he's the leader is the guy that found the parade and got out in front.
That's the way it's supposed to be, actually. Yeah, and I agree with you, right? And that's the way it's supposed to be. We don't elect leaders in this country. We elect representatives.
And the main reason that I called in is I just want people to, even when it gets just down and you just feel like you've gotten kicked in the teeth, just keep on pitching.
There you go.
And that's with a P, but it could be with a B also. Get out there and just agitate. We've got our ward and our county ward meetings coming up here in another couple of weeks. I was a registered Republican until 3 years ago.
Wow.
I'm a precinct vice chair. I'm the county, the vice president of the county club.
For the Democrats now.
For the Democrats.
Yeah.
And I was a Republican until December 3000.
Well, good on you for waking up there, Roy.
If people have to get out there, get involved. Your frequent caller from Colorado was kind of one of my, I kind of modeled him.
Jeff, it's been about a year since we've heard from Jeff, but Jeff in Denver
there,
used to.
Get things happen.
Yeah, he did
really,
the exact same thing you did.
Make things happen.
Yep.
One other quick thing, I don't know if you saw it on the chat room earlier today, but to go back to the commons,
yes, sir.
There was a problem in Missouri. A fellow's house was burning down.
Oh, I had that story.
The fire department showed up and didn't put it out because he hadn't paid his dues.
Yeah, let me just share with our listeners that story. It's in my stack here. Rural firefighters stood by, this is Monette, Missouri, rural firefighters stood by and watched a fire destroy a garage and a vehicle because the property owner had not paid membership dues. Bebaldo Rueda, who was injured battling the flames Monday, offered to pay the dues as the fire blazed away, but the Monette Rural Fire Department does not have a policy for on-the-spot billing. Rueda used a garden hose and buckets to fight the flames while firefighters stood by on the road watching in case the blaze spread to neighboring properties owned by members. The fire eventually burned itself out. Rueda said nobody had told him about the dues policy and he moved in 1.5 years ago. They privatized their fire department and guess what? You don't pay the dues. You're toast, and no pun intended.
And I, one other quick thing and then I'll get off and let somebody
sure.
else jump in. I just attended a meeting with Patsy Madrid, who is running against Heather Wilson, and we're going to take back New Mexico District 1.
Good on you.
We're going to knock it down. We're going to beat them up.
Well, might this be why Heather Wilson is starting to make noises about she doesn't like this illegal wiretapping program and she's starting to take on the administration?
Absolutely. The first poll that came out, they were statistically dead heat. It was Heather on top, 44-43.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
we're gonna kick it. We're
no,
gonna
good
kick
on
it.
You. Good on you, sir.
But get
Thanks.
It around the country.
There
Guys,
you go.
Get out there. Heck, it's fun.
There you go. It's
take care.
It's time to take back this country. You're welcome. Thank you, Roy. Thank you very much for the call and for the fine work that you're doing for democracy in the United States. You're in the Democracy Zone here with Tom Hartman, 16 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Welcome back, my friends, to the vast radical middle conspiracy. Take no imitations. Tom Hartman here with you. Speaking of fighting the law, this news release just in from attorney Larry Klayman. Scott Tooley, a Republican and former congressional aide and law school graduate educated at renowned Christian universities, has filed suit against the president, the vice president, and relevant federal agencies for their illegal surveillance programs. According to the complaint, the Bush-Cheney administration initiated numerous illegal and perpetual surveillance methods on Mr. Tooley and his family after he was incorrectly placed on the TSA's selectee or watch list. Mr. Tooley's case is unique because the suit alleges the Bush administration has used additional illegal surveillance methods on him in addition to the illegal wiretapping. Mr. Tooley is also the first Republican to file suit with regard to the Bush administration's illegal surveillance programs. In the many months prior to filing suit, when Mr. Tooley asked federal agencies for the removal of his name from the TSA's watch list and any documents relating to the matter, he was stonewalled and told that the agencies could neither confirm nor deny that his name was placed on multiple watch lists. Complaint filed today in the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia, Friday, 17 February. Mr. Tooley, represented by Larry Klayman, former chairman of Judicial Watch and former U.S. Senate candidate from Miami, now an attorney in private practice in Miami and Washington, D.C. Fascinating stuff. Fascinating stuff. In the meantime, and we're going to get back to this and other top. By the way, I just want to just wrap up this thing about the fire department that just stood and watched as this guy's house was burning because they had privatized the fire department in this community in Missouri. This is how it used to be in much of the United States, right across the country. And if you didn't have the medallion on your house indicating that you'd paid, then the fire trucks would just drive on by. And, you know, we the people have a better idea. Jeffrey Klayman is with us. Jeffrey Klayman is the editor of the DVD Talk, an online magazine, DVDTalk.com. And Jeffrey, welcome to the program.
Hey, how's it going?
Just great, just great. New DVD is coming out here in February. Soul Train?
Yeah, this comes from Ironweed, which is becoming my favorite DVD magazine. They send out a politically relevant DVD a month to subscribers. And this month they've got a film called Soul Train.
And this is spelled S-E-O-U-L.
Yeah, kind of a play on words there, and it looks at an underground railroad that's happening in North Korea to smuggle refugees out. And if this sounds kind of familiar, you know, it really mirrors, you know, the historical American underground railroad. Very freaky parallels.
Is this the movie where the guys keep going back and forth across the border, and there's a lot of shots of the river that they cross, and then there's a bunch of hidden camera pictures inside North Korea?
Well, there's elements of that, but the real focus is, you know, a lot of kind of what happens to the people who don't get through, and there's an image of a couple trying to get into the Japanese consulate in North Korea. That is just, it'll take your breath away. It's just really, it starts really making this whole issue with North Korea much more palpable and real when you see a mother and their child being pulled away from the gates of the Japanese embassy as they're trying to cry asylum. The issue with North Korea is really, it's when you see the pictures of what's going on there and the famine there and everything, it's a very impactful film.
Yeah, and it's a very grim dictatorship. Troublesome Creek.
This is what they call a Midwestern tale. The Academy Award directors who did one of my favorite films at Sundance, which was So Much So Fast, the film about Lou Gehrig's disease. This is one of the earlier films that's finally coming to DVD, and it looks at an aging couple as they kind of struggle to keep their Midwestern farm when their local bank, who they've had a relationship with for many years, becomes a little less local and a little more national.
It gets bought out by a big bank.
Yeah.
That decides that they're not really in the business of helping support the local community.
Yeah, it happens when you know, it used to be in an era where you go down to your local banker and you had a relationship with them, and when that, you know, farmers used to depend on that.
Yeah, and that's increasingly not America any longer. A new DVD is out called Real Paradise, R-E-E-L Paradise.
Yeah, another play on words here. John Pearson, who's the guy who discovered Spike Lee and Kevin Smith, took his family to Fiji for a year to operate a cinema called the 180 Meridian Cinemas and show free movies to Fijians. And, you know, the documentarian kind of, I think, went out with a thing and said, well, what kind of effect do, you know, American films like, you know, some of the you know, main, you know, pop culture films, what kind of effect does that have on Fijians? You know, do we really export American culture? And the interesting thing about this film is that the amount of impact of the Fijian culture on the Americans who went there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's really, I think, when we look at you know, when Americans are going places and we're dealing with other cultures and, you know, this whole exporting of things like democracy and stuff, I think people don't recognize, wait a second, you know, it's a two-way street when you touch another country.
Well, Fiji is the country where they did the study back about 10 years ago, Harvard did, on the impact of television, and they found that before the introduction of television in some of these communities, there was no anorexia or bulimia, and after 3 years after the introduction of television, something like 13 to 15% of the teenage girls were, purging or starving themselves.
That's unbelievable.
Yeah, it really was a rather startling piece that Harvard University did that was published in, as I recall, a Journal of the American Medical Association many, many years ago. But in any case, Jeffrey Kleinman, DVDtalk.com, the website if you want more information about what are the DVDs for progressives to watch right now. Jeffrey, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks.
Great talking with you. The spirit of resistance to government, so valuable that on certain occasions I wish it always to be kept alive. Thomas Jefferson, 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
All that you touch and all that you see, all that you taste, all you feel.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. 25 minutes, coming up on 25 minutes before the hour. Go to yellowcakewalk.net. And this is the funniest thing. I don't know if this is Mark Crispin Miller or somebody in his employ, but there's this guy standing in front of the White House with a face mask on, holding up a picture, Mark's book, Fooled Again, How the Right Stole the 2004 Election and Why They'll Steal the Next One, Too, Unless We Stop Them. And then down at the bottom it says, Secrets First Service Personnel, get their copies for free. It's great. Yellowcakewalk.net. Run it all together. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Kit in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Kit, what's on your mind today?
Oh, hi. I was listening to you read the law on that executive order. These guys are amazing, aren't they, the way they just make things up as they go
along? Well, what's amazing to me is that at the end of March, Bush gave Cheney the power to classify and declassify documents, and then 3 months later, you've got classified documents. Well, not even 3 months later. I mean, it may have been long before they were outing Joe Wilson. That's probably about the time that they started dropping these classified documents into the mainstream media, and they started appearing on the front page of the New York Times. In fact, that's probably, you know, how Judith Miller was getting a lot of her information. And it was, and in retrospect, it was probably legal because of that executive order.
Well, does that executive order actually give authority to declassify as well as classify?
It does.
I heard you say classify.
No, the later part of it is classified. I've got it around here someplace, and I'll just get the actual executive order.
It seems a lot more dangerous to be able to declassify rather than classify. You know.
Yeah. No, that's it. It explicitly said declassify.
It did.
Yeah. I'm sorry. I've moved on.
These guys aren't dumb.
On my folders, so I don't
these
have it
in front
of me. These
guys aren't dumb. They're just treacherous.
No, I agree. I absolutely agree with you, Kit. Yeah, no, it clearly it clearly said that he had the authority to declassify as well as to classify. So it's amazing.
Nasty business.
Yep. Kid, thanks a lot for the call.
Yeah,
good to hear from you. Jerry in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, WPTT. Hey, Jerry.
Yeah, thanks a lot for taking my call, Tom. How are you doing?
Sure. I'm fine.
Hey, I was wondering, this guy had a Cheney shot. Is he ever going to be able to, like, go to the airport and go through a metal detector? Or, you know, what if he gets...
Is he going to get on the watch list?
Yeah, what if he gets, like, a condition he has to go, like, for one of those magnetic imaging machines in the hospital where there's a powerful magnet, you can't get anywhere near it with metal?
Right.
Will these babies, like, come flying out of his body?
Yeah, well, maybe that's the thing to do is to put him in an MRI machine. It's the problem. It's lead pellets. I'm not sure.
Well, they said steel or lead in the
My
local paper. They said that the birdshot could be either steel or lead.
We had a detailed discussion of this in the chat room, and complete with a whole bunch of links out to manufacturers of birdshot, and they specified either 7 or 7.5 as the gauge of the shot.
Yes.
And I forget which one it was, but one of those is only available in lead, and the other is available in lead or stainless steel. And the diameter that they specified, you remember which of the two it was, but the diameter, and you know, you get it, these are fairly small, so you know.
Oh, yeah, it's a case.
Right.
They set it back up again to show what happened.
Let the amazing Randy. I doubt that's going to happen, but a chief executive, the series of the Bush Administration, Inc., got an unusual article under the subhead front. What? Caller a little earlier in the program who said, here it is. You can find it in today's Wall Street hand, but I cut enough around it. Nah, we'll just read it straight through. The first, would he be Bush's longtime confidant a year earlier in Indonesia, stating October 8th Earth fundraisers, Tiny Village, Cradling in Wonderland, and other books at a local school, where Xerox Corp chief executive. It's the royalty thing. It's like the British royal family, you know, showing up at, you know, Prince Charles, Princess Diana, you know, she used to go to the AIDS hospitals. Well, with royalty, I suppose you expect a certain amount of symbolism. And that's what we're getting here. This is the symbolism of royalty. I mean, the British royal family, they don't have any power anymore. They don't have the ability to, I mean, they haven't got a lot of money, but they don't have the ability to solve the world's problems, to really take them on. But here we have the new royalty in America, the CEOs, now being brought front and center in the realm of what used to be non-governmental organization, non-profit assistance to people, and being promoted, presumably, with your tax dollars in mind. Chairman of Citicorp, Sanford Weill, he says, I think companies are realizing that we all have to be salesmen for America and not just sit back and rely on the government. Well, actually, I would point out to Mr. Weill, chairman of Citigroup, that his company is not unique in, and this is not a specific attack on Citigroup, it's just pointing it out, that his company is among many who are sending American jobs to other countries. You know, speaking as the holder of a credit card that is affiliated with that corporation, I can tell you, you know, there are certain customer service calls that you can make, and you end up talking to somebody in India. GE was the company that pioneered this. In fact, Jack Welch was the guy who pioneered the move to India, and it was reported in the Wall Street Journal. As isn't this a great thing that Jack Welch has figured out that we can use Indian labor for white-collar jobs while we're using Chinese labor for blue-collar jobs? And what's going to be left in the United States? Well, for 5, 10, 15, 20 years, we can kind of vacuum cleaner off. We can suck off the cream, the remnants of the cash that the middle class has left. And then when there's no middle class, these are multinational corporations, they'll simply go someplace else. A big article in one of the papers, as I recall, it was the Wall Street Journal a couple days ago, about how everybody is investing now in German real estate, all the millionaires and billionaires in the United States. So it's like, you know, we've dried out this country. Let's move on to the next. I have to say, it just creeps me out. Armin in Bradenton, Florida. Hey, Armin, welcome to the program.
Yeah, I'm down here in Florida, and thank God I'm far enough south from that stupid dunce from Washington, Bush.
Oh, you've got his brother, though, running your state.
Yeah, he's running it in the ditch.
Yeah, sorry to burst your bubble there, Armin, but...
Well, you think I like that?
No, I know you don't.
I can't stand this bunch of criminal bastards, pardon my language.
Yeah.
But anyway, he's on TV now, and it's amazing. The only local media I can see that has it on is this station out of Braden and Channel 9, and then, of course, Foxaganda.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, he's in the crowd. You know, it's all handpicked. You know, agree with me only, no opposition, no criticizing, or your butt's out the door.
Right.
And he's sitting there trying to sell them on this guest worker. In papers, you know, that's supposed to be the reason why this temporary guest worker thing, he wants to get the camel under the tent so he can finish off the middle class. He's
right.
Trying to sell it to him.
No, he's trying to reinstitute the old Bracero program.
Well, he's trying to say, you know, it's broke. They're using forged documents. He should say, because he ought to know, he used them to go to war in Iraq. But anyway, he's sitting there trying to sell these zombies, and you can look at their faces, and they're just not buying that. They're just you can see.
Even the Republicans are not buying it, you mean?
All the people in the crowd, all this hand-picked bunch of zombies are just kind of like, well, I don't know about that, you know?
Yeah.
I just can't buy it. And then he's going on about Social Security. He says there's not enough people paying in. For God's sakes, Tom, who's done more to destroy the people paying in and the manufacturing base of this country that backed all these social programs and everything besides
right,
right here?
Yep, and the whole wiping out of Social Security began with Ronald Reagan when Greenspan advised Reagan to start borrowing from the Social Security Trust Fund back in 82, excuse me. And that was the beginning of the end of the Social Security Trust Fund anyway. It's 45 minutes past the hour. Thanks, Armin, for the call. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
May you grow up to be righteous. May you grow up to be true. May you always know the truth and see the light surrounding you.
And welcome back, my friends. 9 minutes before the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Just to revisit this, I found a piece of paper here I'd been looking for in this small explosion that we call this desk or work area or whatever it is, studio. Cheney was referring to when Dick Cheney said that he had the unilateral power to declassify classified documents. He was referring to Executive Order 13292, issued by George W. Bush on March 25th, 2003. March, April, May, June, July, just about exactly 4 months, 3.5 months before the outing of Valerie Plame. And right during that period of time when all this classified information was showing up in the press, in the New York Times and Judy Miller publishing all this stuff, and the original executive order, which had been passed by Bill Clinton on April 17, 1995, which gave the president the authority to declassify things, said the authority to classify information originally may be exercised only by the president, and that was changed to the authority to classify information may be exercised only by the president and in the performance of executive duties of the vice president. And then it goes on to say, original classification authorities means an individual authorized in writing either by the president or vice president or by agent. They threw the vice president into there. This is interesting. Now that I'm rereading this thing, I'm just going to have to get back here and go through this, because the top secret original classification authority may be delegated. Top secret or confidential original classification authority may be delegated. Original classification authority means an individual authorized in writing either by the president or the vice president in the performance of executive duties. Interesting. I'm going to have to get the entire thing, because I'm not, you know, as much as Byron York's piece in the National Review, this is what I'm looking at here, February 16th, nationalreview.com is the website, where he has excerpts from these two executive orders along with Cheney's comment. But as the caller earlier had indicated, it seems that this is all about the ability to classify rather than to declassify. We'll be looking into this more. In the meantime, Jeff in South Erie, Vermont, on the line. Hey, Jeff, thanks for listening to us on WVAA there in Burlington. What's up?
Hi, Tom. How are you doing today?
I'm great, but I'll get better.
Okay. Listen, I wanted to call early when you had Congressman Sanders on, but I knew it would, like, sound a little bit too partisan. But I just want to give you a perspective about, like, you know, this whole idea on this new Senate election going on here that we're going to have the richest, you know, the most expensive Senate election in the history of the United States here in little Vermont?
Well, on a per capita basis, yeah.
Right, right. But, yeah, per capita, that's real.
Yeah, it is.
And you know,
because you we are per capita. That's like per
right,
person. Right.
But, up here.
Where are the persons?
Well, listen, here's my point, and I don't want to get into things, but, like, you know, his opponent, Rich Tyrant, Richie Tarrant, okay? Mm-hmm. This is a guy, he has no public record, none at all. His one public record is running IDX. IDX is a corporation up here. And this is, like, please hear me out here. This is a guy who has laid off a lot of Vermonters, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't do it to save his company. He did it for the bottom line. And this is why I think this is a microcosm of what's already been going on in politics in America.
Yeah.
That why do we need a politician whose bottom line is profit? We need politicians, which we already have here in Vermont, but, like, other people in America need to listen to this. We need politicians who bottom line is community.
Yeah.
And taking care of one another.
Well, that's the amazing thing, Jeff, and you know, I lived in Vermont for 10 years. You live there now. You can attest to this, and I think a lot of our listeners don't have a sense of what it's like to live in a little rural state. It's relatively small. You know, Vermont's physically fairly large, but not a lot of people. It's a very rural state. And I lived, you know, out in Northfield for 5 years, literally out in the woods. I was surrounded by a couple hundred acres of land.
And then I
lived for 5 years in downtown Montpelier, you know, in the big city of 9,000 people. and you really get it that politicians live or die based on whether they're out there for the people. Bernie Sanders, literally, he is out there constantly doing these town hall things where I've been at four or five of them, you know, and this was before Bernie was even on my radio program. I would show up as a Vermonter, and people get up and they give him hell, and he listens to them. And you know, it's not a "oh, we love you, Bernie" segment. It's more often than not, "Hey, I've got this problem. What are you going to do about this? What happened with this? Why is this going on?" And he takes this stuff very seriously and goes back and tries to, you know, represent his constituents.
Yeah. Can I say something else?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, Vermont is not the state of a bunch of hippies growing pot out in the middle of nowhere.
No, it's more conservative, actually.
It's actually a very conservative state.
Yeah.
And the reason people like Bernie Sanders up here is that he's got some backbone.
Yeah.
And when they disagree with him, they know this guy is not a corporate whore.
Well, what's amazing is in the Northeast Kingdom of Vermont, the northeast part of Vermont that's the most rural part of Vermont, which George Bush carried by something like 67%, 68%, something like that in the last election, Bernie gets like 70, 80% of the vote.
Yeah. Well, here's why I'm angry. I'm angry that, like, what is it coming down to now? Like, even a little state like this, and that's what I meant earlier by saying it's a microcosm of what's already going on in these places, where you get the richest guy in the state who thinks he should represent the people when he's laying them off.
Right. And just buying his way in. It's a grim thing, Jeff. I thought it was grim when Bloomberg did it in New York. I thought it was grim, frankly, when the Democrat, I'm forgetting his name, in New Jersey did the same thing.
Exactly.
I mean, this is not a partisan thing.
Exactly.
Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it.
Okay.
Good to hear from you. It's 57 minutes past the hour, and I hope you have a great weekend. Coming up on Monday, conservatives, if they endorse the Fuhrer principle, Doug Cunningham with Workers International News is going to be with us. Also, many thanks to my producer, David Poole, to Louise Hartman, Alex Goldmark, Dan Jacobs at Air America, Ben and Shelby at the White Rose Society, at Sue Nethercutt, Mike Toth, and we'll see you all on Monday. Do good.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
This is Vivilnik Raskin. I'm the president and founder of the Organic Wine Company. What happened when you, Thomas, gave us a plug, the phone started ringing. The first person said, "Whatever it is that you're selling, I want to buy it." And for the next few hours,